It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tortoise.
Hello and welcome to this bonus episode of the News Meeting with James O'Brien, the LBC presenter, who's written another book that I suspect is going to be a bestseller too, How They Broke Britain. There are either people, James, who never want to hear a thing you said or actually want to hold it close.
Yeah, and it gives them hope or sense of despair. Build a bridge between them or hope that some of the people who fit into the first category might start paying attention to some of the stuff that I've said, most obviously about Brexit, Donald Trump and Boris Johnson, all of which have not turned out perfectly.
This book, though, is about 10 individuals who you say broke Britain. Is it really about the people who broke Britain or is it about Brexit?
But the Brexit vote happened in an ecosystem. Ecosystem is the word I use far too much in the book, but I couldn't really think of a suitable synonym. And it goes back way before 2016. It goes back to Rupert Murdoch buying the Sun. It goes back to the circumstances in which David Cameron both became leader of the Conservative Party and thought that he could, you know, deploy his arsenal of talents and attributes to unravel the Gordian knot of Euroscepticism where every other previous leader had failed, and the sort of complacent arrogance that led to the promise to hold a referendum and the belief that he'd come back from Brussels with some sort of golden goose or goose that lays golden eggs. And then, you know, you look at the subsequent role of Jeremy Corbyn, you look at his role in the actual referendum campaign or his absence of a role in the referendum campaign, and you look at the what was created by the media, what was created by newspapers, and the fact that many people believed things that were profoundly untrue. So all of that contributed to and arguably created the Brexit vote. But the ecosystem was under construction, both deliberately and accidentally, long before the referendum was called.
So just talk through, who did break Britain?
There's three engines of change that I identify. The first is a right-wing media that has just gone to places that it had never gone to before. You're looking at the demonisation of not just refugees, as we've seen latterly, but foreigners in general, and foreigners with jobs, and foreigners with every right to be here, and the seeping of that sort of racism or jingoism into the ethno-nationalist idea that people who are not white are somehow not British or are still foreigners or settlers, which is a word that I've seen some of the nastier commentators using recently. And that has been underway since probably Larry Lamb's time at The Sun, certainly since Kelvin McKenzie's, and it has, through The Telegraph and The Spectator, it's sort of dressed itself up in more recent years in much, much more respectable clothes. So the sort of attitudes that might once have been a Sun column are now just as likely to appear in the Sunday Times or The Telegraph. And it's no accident that a lot of the writers that Murdoch favours now write for both his red meat outlets and for his supposedly more cerebral outlets. They just use a slightly different vocabulary to deliver more or less the same messages. And then the Euro, for want of a better word, because Euroscepticism sounds relatively mild, relatively benign. That makes me think of Bill Cash. It doesn't make me think of, you know, rabid representations of the European Union as being some form of Fourth Reich or being something dedicated to the denigration of British interests and British values, which is patently untrue. It's a flawed, fallible institution, but the idea that it exists to actually damage Britain took hold on a scale that could never have happened without that level of media absurdity. And that in turn has sort of created a new generation of conservative politician that has really come to the fore since 2016. So the idea that Nadine Dorries can be Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport is objectively ridiculous by any traditional measure. That Jacob Rees-Mogg, who was a standing joke until roughly the moment that the referendum result dropped, can end up as business secretary, Secretary of State for Business, is palpably absurd. And yet it's normal in the ecosystem that has grown out of the ecosystem that allowed the crazy stuff to happen. And then the third, so that's the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party, that has no place for a Nicholas Soames or a David Gawk or an Anna Soubry, or a Ken Clark, actually. And the media, which bears no resemblance even to what it looked like in some areas in the 90s. And then you've got this proliferation of lobby groups that call themselves think tanks and that are secretly funded and that have managed to inform and infest almost every level of public discourse while never, ever disclosing whose interests it is they are acting in, or indeed what qualifications they have to pontificate on weighty subjects on every programme under the sun.
So you break those down. You do Rupert Murdoch, Paul Dacre, Andrew Neil,
yes,
as examples in media.
Neil crosses quite a few of these categories, actually. He's not exclusively media because he was the first newspaper editor to publish pamphlets published by the Institute of Economic Affairs as though they were journalism.
Well, let's park the bus there for a second, because I thought that... Actually, I generally don't ever really talk about Murdoch. I worked there. I worked at the Times, of course.
Yeah.
And... But I thought there was one thing that you did in that chapter about Murdoch that was really astute, which was that appreciation of him as both this journalist and businessman, and this idea of him, I always thought, as the grandson of someone who covered Gallipoli, believed in the power of journalism and reporting, and at the same time someone who left Oxford University and became obsessed and fascinated by tabloid journalism and the power of that journalism. And in that Murdoch chapter, you also do something, James, which is reflect, and I haven't seen anyone else note this, it's not the fact that there aren't brilliant people working for the Times and brilliant journalists. It's that within the culture of that paper, and I was part of it, you don't criticise the voices and views of the others. And so within those institutions, within those organizations, you may think that someone is really wrong, but you don't call them out. And that, I thought, was really, really well observed. On the Andrew Neil chapter, I thought, I'm not sure this is fair, in that Andrew Neil, you may not share his views and you may dislike his kind of personal style, and you may also think that, you know, he has no business keeping the likes of Rod Liddell or Douglas Murray in his pages. But it felt to me as though at the core of it was an argument about Andrew Neil having such prominence on the BBC. And I looked at that and thought, I'm not sure your argument's right there. I'm not sure that it's the case that kind of, if you like, people who seem or have conservative histories get a kicking on the BBC, and that, you know, people who've come from the left are sort of somehow ushered in and allowed through. I'm not sure that's the case. I mean, personally, I appointed the former editor of the Evening Standard to be the editor of the Today programme and a former deputy editor of the Guardian to be the editor of Newsnight. It feels to me as though there's a mix of people there.
They're off air, both of those appointments are off air, which means they don't generally come to the attention of right-wing newspapers. They don't generally earn the ire of Paul Dacre. You're not really, I mean, Sarah Sands might be a slight exception to the rule, but you're not going to have a Daily Mail photographer parked outside her house in the way that you would outside Emily Maitlis's or even Gary Lineker's, and Andrew Neil never got any of that. The parallel I use that's more helpful, perhaps, is a 25-year-old fact-checker called Oscar Bentley,
yes,
who appeared on the Daily Politics on his first ever shift to provide a very sober, evidence-based analysis of why Rishi Sunak can't really claim the Tories have halved crime, because he's comparing numbers that included fraud and computer crime with numbers that didn't. And the day after, a 25-year-old fact-checker did that, He was being monstered in the Telegraph, the Sun, the Mail, the Express, and for more than one day. And his crime was to have posted, as a student, a picture of his dog on a Facebook page called Dogs for Jeremy Corbyn, whereas the man who presented the Daily Politics for a decade, actually presented it, was publishing a magazine that goes about as close to the unacceptable in the context of commentary and opinion writing as any in the country.
But, James, I'm with you on that, because partly, firstly, I'm one of those people who's of the view that Gary Lineker should be able to express what he thinks as a citizen of this country and has a different job when he's on air, right?
Yes, of course.
I appreciate, of course, that Andrew Neil's slightly different. You know, he's in News and Current Affairs. He's got to behave differently. But I'd look at him and, you know, I worked with him obviously at the BBC and worked with him here at Tortoise. He did a podcast for us here. I would still say, as an interviewer, as someone who essentially interrogated people of every party, I thought he did that incredibly well.
I completely agree. I mean, he's just an exemplar of double standards, because the BBC is so frightened of the kind of criticism that people like Emily Maitlis and Lewis Goodall have received that they will keep people like him on air doing a brilliant job and lose people who also do a brilliant job, but who are not going to be acceptable to the Paul Dacres of this world.
But, James, isn't that the extension of the Paul Dacre chapter in some ways?
Yes.
What you're really describing is the extent to which the BBC can be, and at times has been, intimidated by the Mail or the Murdoch press.
Yes, and I'd use Nick Robinson as another example, and this is in no way impugning his journalism, but he was president of the Macclesfield Young Conservatives, the Cheshire Young Conservatives, the Oxford University Young Conservatives, and then the Young Conservatives. Imagine for a moment anybody who had held positions like that in the Labour student movement being promoted to a really high presenting position on the BBC at the moment. It's not impossible that it would happen.
David Aronovich was head of the NUS. He was on the BBC for ages.
But he wasn't presenting the flagship news programme in the morning, interviewing government politicians opposition politicians. And it's, again, it's simply the ecosystem. That's why I have to keep returning to this word. It's the ecosystem in which we have redefined what is normal and what is not normal. It is normal for a former head of the Conservative Student Union to hold one of the plummest jobs in BBC presenting. It's almost inconceivable for a former head of the Labour Student Union to hold a comparable position. And the Oscar Bentley example shows us why.
I suppose I sympathise with the kind of spirit of this fight. I don't think the examples are right. So I have to confess I haven't read Nadine Dorris's book. Have you read it?
I haven't read it, but I'm happy to take David Icke's analysis that it proves he's been right all along.
Fair enough. That's the best possible. You know, you can see it on the paperback cover right
Stick
now.
Stick that on the cover immediately.
But so I've read some reporting of the book.
Mm.
One element of it, which is amazing to me, is that Nadine Dorris wanted Michael Grade to be appointed to Ofcom, the media regulator, but Robbie Gibb, the former Andrew Neil producer who then went to go and work in Number 10, who then ends up on the board of the BBC, was lobbying to get Stephen Gilbert in that position, not Michael Grade, to Ofcom, which of course regulates the BBC, has oversight over the whole media landscape. That feels to me more of the problem that you're talking about. That feels to me more like a world in which, as you say in the book, there are no rules.
I agree. I mean, that only emerged subsequent to me finishing that book. Robbie Gibb is fairly well featured in the book, actually. He's an extremely good example of what I'm describing. But yeah, I am describing something a little different to what you describe, except that Robbie Gibb also tried to lecture Newsnight staff on what impartiality was. And Lewis Goodall, who was very much a rising star there, was told on several occasions that Robbie Gibb has really got your card marked. He's really keeping a close eye on you. He's really coming for you. And Lewis would reflect on that by saying, well, how can it be that I am getting crucified for supposed impartiality because I was the sixth form representative of the Erdington Labour Party, and Robbie Gibb has literally just just left Downing Street as director of communication. So this is, it's like the parameters of what's normal. And I have to, you have to step back from it. And it's very, very, very hard to do, to step back from it. Because if you're booking someone from the Institute of Economic Affairs or someone from the Taxpayers Alliance, you haven't got time to ask whether they've got any business being in studios. And if you're talking about who is in prominent positions at the Beeb and who is not, you haven't really got time to work out whether or not there is a relationship between how those appointments would be greeted in the broader media landscape and why some people come in for kicking. How can Carol Vorderman be compelled to resign from BBC Wales and a show that she presents from a very whimsical position? The last episode I heard, she shared at some length her disdain for pickled onions. But Carol Vorderman has been targeted by the other media institutions in this country, and the BBC gets rid of Carol Vorderman because they are frightened of the noise. They are frightened of the noise, and the noise never reaches Andrew Neil or Nick Robinson.
How did your experience presenting Newsnight affect the way you think about it?
It was huge. I didn't notice at the time quite how huge it was. There's one moment that was the moment I realised I couldn't stay. And it was more to do with the bogus nature of balance or false equivalence than it was to do with any of the things that we've touched on so far. And it was when the sort of lunatic fringe of the lunatic fringe of Brexit were talking about going WTO, leaving without any trade agreements whatsoever, and we'd be absolutely fine because, well, we're British, aren't we? Seem to be the extent of the logical analysis. And let's go WTO. And it was in the Tory party. It wasn't just UKIP-y or newspaper-y. It was actually in the Tory party. You'd have prominent Brexiter MPs, ERG people actually insisting that we could do it. Now, it's observably untrue. It's objectively untrue that we'd be okay in those circumstances. But by that point, Britain had already become so broken that even challenging the blatant falsehood of that would have been construed as bias if it had happened on the BBC. So we get Pascal Lamy booked for the programme, former Director General of the World Trade Organization. And I say to the team, that's great. How long? Let's try and clear a bit more of the programme, because I'd like to talk to him for as long as I can, because most of us need a real and very quick crash course in what the World Trade Organization does and what it is and what it means, because we've never had to think about it before because we've been in the European Union. They say, OK, well, we've got 10 or 11 minutes. And I'm like, that's great. That's brilliant. Let's start working out what we're going to talk about. And they say, the boss says, well, we're going to have to have, well, obviously, we're going to have another guest as well. And I said, why? Why do we have to have another guest? Pascal Lamy is going to come in and talk to us about what the World Trade Organization does and is. And he ran it. How can anybody balance that out? Are you going to come on and say, well, no, it doesn't do that?
Anti-WTO. Or,
yes, no, you didn't. And I said, all right, so who have we got? And they said, Andrea Leadsom. And I thought, this isn't right. There's something very, very wrong here, because I could not be less interested in what Andrea Leadsom has to say about. And so I interview Lamy. He's brilliant, as you'd expect. And I have to turn from the former Director General of the World Trade Organization to Andrea Leadsom, who I don't have enough knowledge of her CV to tell you what her qualification. I think she might have worked in the city once. I have to turn to Andrea Leadsom and say, Andrea, you disagree. And we're off. And that's where we'd got to by then.
So what have you come to think about impartiality?
I think that impartiality and balance are two very different things. And I think that impartiality, the judgment on impartiality, should probably be confined to what happens on air. I think if you are obviously, rabidly impartial off air, then there will come a point where conversations would need to be had and decisions would have to be made about whether or not you can present a news programme in good faith and retain the confidence of the audience, not the confidence of Paul Dacre or Tony Gallagher, the confidence of the audience. And that would allow Andrew Neil to carry on and Nick Robinson to carry on and Emily Maitlis to carry on and various other people to carry on. But that's impartiality. The problem, my big problem, is with balance. My big problem is with the idea of having to book people to offer up the alternative view. I always think that if I mentioned Galileo in the podcast proper because I think about him quite a lot, oddly, when we're having these conversations. I think about heresy and I think about someone being demonstrably and completely correct about something with which almost the entire world disagrees. And if Galileo appeared on Newsnight 20 years ago to talk about heliocentrism, they'd have had to book Nigello Lorsini to insist in fact that heliocentrism wasn't true at all.
They would have been told that that was false balance, but they probably would have booked it nonetheless.
Yes.
But what happens if and when Labour wins the next election? You suspect they will.
Yes, I think so.
And I know this is not going to be the first time you're going to be on air trying to make sense of the country and politics when Labour's in power.
No.
But it's different, James, because, frankly, you're much better known. People have now, for a decade or more, looked to you to try and articulate an argument that's often but not solely against the Conservative Party. It's striking to me that in the book, one of the figures who broke Britain is Jeremy Corbyn. So it's not like you're going to run from an argument with the Labour Party. But how do you begin to think about what your job will be in the event that Keir Starmer's Prime Minister?
Well, I've spent 7 years describing the news as bad for the soul, but very good for business. And I think I could live with a few years of it being good for the soul and very bad for business. I mean, it's a commercial organisation, LBC, and there is only so much diminishment of audience that could be sustained. I hope I don't. I hope I carry on. We don't only talk about politics. We certainly don't only talk about Brexit anymore, but in terms of speaking truth to power, if power is not behaving abominably, regardless of who's holding it, then speaking truth to power, if it's not too pompous to describe myself like that, speaking truth to power becomes less important.
You say at the beginning of the book, I said, you know, there are no rules. How do you create a country where there are better rules?
Well, there was. I did. You know, you're so right when you say I've been talking about this a lot, because in Norwich last night, I was asked a similar question from the audience, and I was astonished by how much optimism I derived from my own answer, which had never actually occurred to me before. But think of Amber Rudd. Think of Amber Rudd's resignation, which feels like generations ago. It feels like a different age entirely. And she resigned, pretty much because of mistakes that somebody else had made, but which she was required by convention to take responsibility for. Theresa May was Prime Minister, not Anthony Eden. It was well within the last
living memory, yes.
Yeah, last 6 or 7 years. So it's there.
And look, she resigned over the failure of the Home Office to handle people who came as part of the Windrush generation.
Compare that to Owen Paterson. Just, 2 years later, when someone is found to have committed egregious breaches of parliamentary standards, and the response to that by Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson and Charles Moore and sundry other members of the groupings that I describe at length in the book, they launched the Save Owen Paterson Society. Their response to rule breaking was to try to set fire to the rule book. So it's not an enormous ask or an enormously optimistic position to simply hope that we can dial things back to the time when Amber Rudd resigned and when Priti Patel got sacked for flying off for secret meetings with the foreign government in Israel and lying to the Prime Minister about it. This was all in political terms yesterday. It wasn't 10 years ago or 20 years ago. This was under Theresa May. So answering the question last night made me realise that rather than trying to assemble some wonderful blueprint for a new Jerusalem, actually the first step towards restoring normality is going back to our last version of it.
Just, we do what we do, we have leaders who expect us to behave to certain rules.
And if your Prime Minister and your independent advisor on ministerial standards tells you that someone's a bully, you just sack them.
Do you think now you'll see the UK rejoin the European Union in your lifetime?
Well, that calls my mortality into question, doesn't it? That's the thing. And my blood pressure and sundry other sort of variables. I don't know. I think
you're a rejoiner, are you?
Not now. I mean,
are you not?
Well, I want to. I think we're obviously better off in it. But the question you ask is much more complicated than that. It's not magic wand territory, is it? Number one, I don't think there'll be any case of them wanting us back in until it's an almost neutral political issue in this country. They're not going to want to be a football that we spend another couple of years kicking around to the detriment of everybody involved. And then there's the terms on which we'd rejoin, which would almost certainly be considerably inferior from a Eurosceptic point of view from the terms on which we left. But I think what will happen, and you see this actually happening all the time, but again, because of the ecosystem in which we all live, you don't notice it. It's not properly reported unless you do what we do and you get paid to pay attention. We're chipping away already at the things we were supposed to celebrate losing. We're either restoring or retaining. So this week, a very quiet story about workers' rights, about how we will actually align with the legislation that was passed when we were members of the European Union. We're not going to set fire to that, what Jacob Rees-Mogg would call red tape, because it would be, I mean, stupid to do so, which is always the point. It's as if the provenance of legislation is more important than the probity of it. That's the fundamental Brexit position, is because it smells a bit French or it smells a bit German. We don't want it. And you say it's actually a really good law. It's a really good protection for British workers. It just so happens that French workers in Limoges enjoy the same protections as well. That's not a reason to chuck it away just because it's got, a broader application across Europe. So you're going to see it in words like alignment and words like exemption. Exemptions for specific areas of employment. I can't keep track of how many exemptions are being issued. So eventually we're going to have liberty of mobility, which will be nothing like freedom of movement, but it will apply to everybody from all of the exempted sectors coming into this country without, of course, and this is the kicker, there's always a kicker, without any reciprocal arrangements for British workers going overseas, going to Europe.
I know you've got to go and you've got to get on a train. You've got to go up to Scotland. I'm just imagining you getting into the carriage, sitting down in your seat, and finding a member of the Conservative cabinet in the chair next to you. Which one would you most like it to be?
Oh, Lordy. I'll be travelling in economy, so it's not going to happen. I'll be in standard class. I think Jeremy Hunt is probably the most clubbable. He did my holiday cover, and my producer, Eleanor, really liked him. And that is a very high recommendation. I can't list the people that have made less felicitous impressions on my team when I've been away. But Jeremy Hunt, I think, would be quite interesting to talk to. But you're presuming a degree of indiscretion that is unlikely to be. Or you're presuming they wouldn't get up and change carriages, which is probably optimistic anyway.
James O'Brien, thank you very much.
James, thank you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Afua Hirsch.
I'm Peter Frankopan.
And in our podcast, Legacy, we explore the lives of some of the biggest characters in history.
This season, we're exploring the life of Cleopatra.
An iconic life full of romances, sieges, and tragedy. But who was the real Cleopatra? It feels like her story's been told by others with their own agenda for centuries.
But her legacy is enduring, and so we're going to dive into how her story has evolved all the way up to today.
I am so excited to talk about Cleopatra, Peter.
Love Cleopatra.
She is an icon.
She's the most famous woman in antiquity. It's got to be up there with the most famous woman of all time.
But I think there's a huge gap between how familiar people are with the idea of her compared to what they actually know about her life and character.
So for pyramids, Cleopatra and Cleopatra's nose.
Follow Legacy now wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can binge entire seasons early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.